and its political, racial and religious diversity, the Commonwealth remained a strong force for good. BBC News.
You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC with me, Frederick Dove. Despite being physically attacked on Christmas Eve, Pope Benedict has given his traditional Christmas Day blessing to crowds gathered in the Vatican's St. Peter's Square. Just before midnight mass, he was pulled to the ground by a woman who jumped over barricades and ran towards him. But today, he was greeted by children chanting as he appeared on a balcony overlooking the square. In his address, delivered in several languages, the Pope urged wealthy nations to show compassion towards refugees and emphasised what he believes is the true meaning of Christmas.
May the birth of the Prince of Peace remind the world where its true happiness lies. May your hearts be filled with hope and joy, for the Saviour has been born for us.
Earlier, our Rome correspondent David Willey gave my colleague Claire Balderson more details about the Pope's Christmas address.
The Pope referred to the small Christian community in Iraq. He showed compassion for them and said that they are under severe stress. He also talked about the problems of minorities in other countries who have to leave their homes for various reasons, whether it's political intolerance or hunger or for any other reason. He wanted to show the relevance of the Christian message to the problems that many people face today, not only in the developing world, but also in the wealthier countries.
Was there any indication of how he is following that assault last night?
Well, he appeared a little unsteady on his feet as he came out onto the balcony of St. Peter's, facing the crowd in St. Peter's Square. He spoke, however, I thought, with a fairly firm voice, and he seems really to be none the worse for wear. He is a bit frail at the age of 82, and the Vatican is doing its best to play down, I think, the seriousness of this rather difficult breach of security, which took place just after 10 o'clock last night, as the Pope was entering the Basilica and walking in procession with his senior aides and cardinals down the length of the nave.
And some more details are emerging now, aren't they, about who she was?
Her name's Susanna Maiolo. She is of dual Swiss and Italian nationality. She's 25 years old and she's at present under psychiatric assessment in a Rome hospital. It's not certain whether she'll be charged with any offence.
Is it perhaps, though, rather surprising that she could get so close to actually assault the pontiff?
Not really, when you consider that the Pope processes during religious ceremonies in close proximity to crowds who gather wherever he goes. But normally the security people are very vigilant. What is strange is that this appears to have been her second attempt to attack the Pope, the first being exactly 1 year ago when she was actually filmed trying to get over the security barrier. But on that occasion, she was successfully restrained by the Vatican police.
And that was David Willey in Rome. The Taliban in Afghanistan have released a video which shows a US soldier who disappeared almost 6 months ago in Paktika province in the east of the country. Amber Hassan Etirajan reports.
The video shows a man wearing sunglasses and a US military-style helmet and uniform. He appears healthy and speaks calmly and clearly. In the video, he gives details about himself and his family before criticizing the United States over the war in Afghanistan and its relations with Muslims. He also says the conflict in Afghanistan is going to be the next Vietnam for the United States unless the American people, in his words, stop all this nonsense. A Taliban spokesman then calls for the release of Taliban prisoners in exchange for the soldier. The NATO-led forces in Afghanistan condemned the video as an affront to the soldier's family at Christmas and said he had clearly been forced to read a prepared statement. Private Bagdal disappeared from his base near the border with Pakistan 5 months after arriving in Afghanistan. The insurgents had also released a video of him a few weeks after he was captured. It's not clear when the latest video was made. Private Bagdal is believed to be the first American soldier to be captured alive by Taliban militants in Afghanistan.
Ambarasan Etirajan reporting. There are reports that one of Osama bin Laden's daughters has taken refuge at the Saudi embassy in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Earlier this week, newspapers in Saudi Arabia and Britain reported that several other children of Osama bin Laden have been living in a compound in Iran since fleeing Afghanistan in 2001. With more details on that story, here's Martin Venard of our West Asia desk.
The Iranian Foreign Minister, Manoucher Mottaki, said he had been told that Iman bin Laden was currently in the Saudi embassy. He said on state-run television that he did not know how the young woman had got into Iran or into the embassy. Mr. Mottaki added that Iran wanted proof of her identity before she was allowed to leave the country.
The individual can leave Iran with proof of identification and a laissez-passer. Discussions have taken place recently between the foreign ministry and the Saudi embassy. We're not certain that she is the daughter of bin Laden, but that is what the embassy has said.
Earlier this week, media reports said Iman bin Laden had gone to the embassy after evading her guards in Tehran. The report said the young woman and several other of Osama bin Laden's children and relatives had been held by the Iranian authorities for 8 years after crossing from Afghanistan. Mr. Mottaki was not asked about them by Iranian TV. Part of Osama bin Laden's family were living with him in Afghanistan before the American invasion. Earlier this year, US officials said one of Osama bin Laden's sons, Saad, who had reportedly been living in Iran, was probably killed by an American missile strike in Pakistan.
And that was Martin Venard. You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC World Service. Still to come in this edition, the people of Romania remember the overthrow and execution of their former dictator Nicolae Ceausescu 20 years ago. Today's main news, Pope Benedict has carried out his traditional Christmas duties despite an incident in which he was assaulted by a young woman. It's coming up to 1913 GMT. There has been international condemnation of a decision by the Chinese authorities to jail the country's most prominent dissident, Liu Xiaobo, for 11 years after finding him guilty of incitement to subvert state power. The sentence was described as extremely harsh by the United Nations and also criticised by Gregory May, a spokesman for the US Embassy in Beijing.
The United States government is deeply concerned by the sentence of 11 years in prison announced today in the case of prominent Chinese democracy activist Liu Xiaobo under the charge of inciting subversion of state power. Persecution of individuals for the peaceful expression of political views is inconsistent with internationally recognized norms of human rights.
Liu Xiaobo took part in the Tiananmen Square demonstrations 20 years ago and is a campaigner for political reform in China. He was detained last December, and our correspondent in Beijing, Michael Bristow, has been following his case.
He was accused of incitement to subvert state power. But what that meant specifically was that he'd helped draft a document called Charter 08. Now, this was a political manifesto calling for a change to the political system in China. He also authored, wrote a number of articles criticizing China's one-party state. And the prosecutor cited both those examples of reason why they put him on trial. Mr. Liu, he wasn't a major rabble-rouser. He wasn't a really inspirational figure who gathered people together and got them out onto the streets. He was a former university professor. The fact that they've decided to go after him and to put him in prison for such a long time suggests that they're fearful of basically anybody who stands out, stands up and challenges their authority.
Michael Bristow in Beijing. In Ireland, two more Roman Catholic bishops have submitted their resignations a month after an independent report detailed how child sex abuse was covered up for 3 decades by the Catholic Church. As Jane Wall reports, this has now led to a total of 4 bishops standing down.
The announcement that 2 more bishops were planning to step down came during Christmas Mass. A statement by the bishops, Eamon Walsh and Raymond Field, was read out to worshippers at church services across Dublin. In it, they said they hoped their resignation would help to bring the peace and reconciliation of Jesus Christ to the victims of child sexual abuse, though both bishops said they'd done nothing wrong. Earlier this month, 2 other bishops resigned after being named as negligent, following a government-led investigation which found that church leaders in Dublin spent decades shielding more than 170 paedophile priests from the law. The news has profoundly undermined the reputation of the Irish Church, once a key institution in the country. It now faces an uncertain future. Attendance at Mass has fallen dramatically in recent years, and with many priests approaching retirement, there's a chronic shortage of new, younger ministers to replace them. In his Christmas message to the church, the Archbishop of Ireland referred to the horrendous scandal of child abuse.
That report by Jane Waugh. And next to Romania. That was the sound on Christmas Day 20 years ago of the firing squad, which executed Romania's president Nicolae Ceaușescu and his wife Elena. The revolution, which overthrew Ceaușescu's government and with it communist rule in Romania, claimed over 1,000 lives. Our Central Europe correspondent Nick Thorpe looks back at the bloody events of 1989 and their legacy.
The last film of Nicolae and Elena Ceaușescu shows them with their hands being tied behind their backs. "What are you doing? You're hurting my wrists," says Elena. "Shame, shame," says the president. The cameraman was late getting to the actual execution. You hear the volley of shots, then see the couple crumpled lifeless on the ground. 20 years on, there's a sudden surge of interest in the couple and the country they ruthlessly ruled over. A new play, The Last Hours of the Ceaușescus, premiered in Bucharest before going on tour. There are new books and documents which endeavour to shed more light on an era which seems increasingly alien to Romanians today. And there is some nostalgia, not for the food shortages and the web of police informers, but for a world where a job and a flat were guaranteed, provided you were obedient to the state.
Nick Thorpe. In Australia, one of the world's most testing ocean races is about to get underway. 100 vessels will try to complete the annual dash from Australia's biggest city, Sydney, to Hobart, capital of the island of Tasmania. The crews taking part, among them an all-disabled crew and entrants from as far away as Europe, will set sail in Sydney Harbour on Saturday before embarking on a 628 nautical mile journey down the southeast coast of Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
This Blue Water Classic is a monumental test of character. Crew members will have to withstand sleep deprivation, seasickness and monster waves. Alan Grundy is embarking on his 10th Sydney to Hobart. He's on board the yacht Kaz, which is run by sailors with disabilities, including those who are paraplegic, blind and suffering from multiple sclerosis. Many have never competed in such a taxing event, and Mr. Grundy is warning his colleagues to expect a rough ride to Tasmania.
It's up and over waves, bang, bang, bang. Terribly uncomfortable. Some people feeling ill, sitting on the rail, getting wet, cold, tired, wondering why the hell you're here. Dreaming of getting to Hobart, just so that you can have a cold beer and sit in a place that doesn't move.
Fellow crew member Liesl Tesch, who's also the captain of the Australian women's wheelchair basketball team, says she's ready for this big test.
Mate, I don't think my disability is going to get in the way. I don't think disabilities is going to be an issue out there. It's just getting this boat from one place to another, and whatever the wind throws at us, that's going to be the challenge out there. Nothing to do with what we live with every day.
The fastest boats aim to complete the trip to Hobart in less than 48 hours. The race, though, can be a deadly enterprise. In 1998, six people died when a savage storm battered the fleet, prompting a wholesale review of safety standards.
Phil Mercer reporting, and the Sydney-Hobart race is due to start at 1 o'clock local time on Saturday afternoon. Remember to keep following our main stories. If you have a mobile phone or out and about, all you need to do is save bbc.com/news on your phone. The main news at the moment from the BBC, Pope Benedict has carried out his traditional Christmas duties despite an incident in which he was assaulted by a young woman. You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC World Service. It's 19:20 GMT.
This is Martin Webber with reflections on the business news of the past year. 2009 was pretty traumatic for the world economy. In fact, global output actually fell for the first time since the 1930s depression. But it wasn't quite as tough as many had feared 12 months ago when the whole financial system was close to breaking down. The authorities' response was quick. They cut interest rates, boosted money supply, and spent more, in particular subsidising consumers who wanted to buy a new car. How economies will react when such stimulus is removed in the coming months is yet to be seen. In the United States, unemployment soared to its highest level for 26 years. One of those statistics is this man from Rhode Island, who's now been out of work for a year and a half.
It's very degrading, it's very depressing, it's very humiliating. It's terrible. It's terrible. I've never seen things as bad in my whole life. I'm 53 years of age, and I've been out of work before, and I've been out of work for a few months here and there, but never like this.
The US jobless rate is now 10%. Still not as bad as the 30s depression, when unemployment hit 25%, but a shock to Americans nonetheless. The new workshop of the world is, of course, China. There, 150 million people are migrant workers, employed in factories hundreds of miles from their home villages. Many had to return to the countryside after factories closed when export orders dried up at the start of 2009. But with the Chinese government pumping cash into the economy, the migrant workers are on the move again. We caught up with this man looking for work in a country where $10 a day is a sought-after rate.
It is really important. For family expenses, we need to send money back home from working away. And we could buy better furniture and make a comfy home. It will mean my parents can have easier lives, and there will be better conditions for my kids, the next generation.
In the end, China achieved a strong 9% annual growth rate, adding to the sense that the worst of the global crisis has passed. But the question is, have world leaders got to the root causes of what went wrong? Here's President Obama at last September's summit in Pittsburgh.
We will tie executive pay to long-term performance so that sound decisions are rewarded instead of short-term greed. In short, our financial system will be far different and more secure than the one that failed so dramatically last year.
But summit declarations and changes in the real world are two different things. As the year closes, the largest banks in the UK and US have once again announced big short-term profits and big bonuses for their traders, to the outrage of the general public. After the speculative bubble of the 1920s blew up in the 1929 Wall Street crash, politicians moved fast to break up banks and ring-fence the cash of ordinary citizens from the bank's speculative trading divisions, known as investment banks. Many economists say this should happen again, but there's no sign of such a move so far. The biggest bank bailout in Britain came at the Royal Bank of Scotland, or RBS. It has $450 billion of so-called toxic assets that are so unwanted they're impossible to value. The new boss brought in to clean up RBS is Stephen Hester. We asked him why bankers still wanted to be paid so much.
I want to be clear, we really get this. We're in no misapprehension, we're in no Alice in Wonderland about people's views on bankers' pay. We are leading the world in how we pay our people, in removing the cash bonuses, in putting in deferral and clawback and so on. But it does nobody any good if good people don't want to work for RBS.
But shouldn't banks now be broken up into the bits that hold ordinary savings and riskier investment banks?
I think it's wrong to get philosophically hung up on shape of banks. What we know is that the majority of banks that have failed have been narrow banks, either narrow investment banks or narrow mortgage banks or narrow consumer finance banks. So I'm afraid the evidence simply is not there for saying it was the shape of banks that was the problem, and the evidence in fact is that narrow banks have tended to be riskier than more broadly based banks.
Stephen Hester with a robust defence of conglomerate banks. But one man who thinks the status quo has to change is the respected London economist Roger Bootle. He thinks conglomerate banks should be broken up. But what of Stephen Hester's argument that the universal banks, that had lots of different types of operations, actually did better during the crisis than the narrow banks?
I don't know how you can argue that universal banks did better when we had RBS as a universal bank, it did pretty badly, it seems to me. Maybe there's someone around that RBS did better than that other person, I don't know, but I don't know quite who on earth they are. All sorts of banks did badly in this kerfuffle. I don't think that's frankly the issue. The issue is about getting clarity about which institutions the taxpayer should support, because we can't have a system in the future under which banks can do whatever they like, pay themselves whatever they like. Oh, and by the way, when they get into trouble, let's have the taxpayer bail them out. That simply won't wash.
But in the meantime, you've got RBS still trying to build up an investment banking division where 4,000 or 5,000 traders are taking speculative positions in financial markets.
Now, I don't understand why RBS is doing that, I have to say. I don't understand why the government's allowing them to do it either. It seems to me that their priority ought to be to get out of such areas and to concentrate their firepower on providing finance for British business and British households.
But isn't the problem there's not actually that much money in that, whereas in the short term, these investment banking activities, which generally involve taking on risk, being paid for it, are earning them a lot more money?
Well, there's a paradox about investment banking, because when it's profitable, it's very, very profitable. We don't actually know whether, over the long run, actually it's profitable at all. If you tot it up, the money made over the years against various bailouts, whether investment banks actually make any money at all.
So these big banks like Goldman Sachs, do they really generate wealth for an economy?
Goldman Sachs is the most successful investment bank by far. There is, though, I think, a legitimate question about quite how far its own success translates into benefits for the economy overall. If it's a merger and acquisition, the evidence is pretty clear on all this, that actually, on average, this activity adds nothing at all to human welfare. Actually, it destroys value. It's all about the ego and the rewards of the chief executives concerned. Now, when they're commissioning an investment bank to work with them, are they interested in the costs of this to the shareholder? No, they're not. If the real owners of the business, that's to say people like you and me, through our pension funds and our insurance policies, if we were actually choosing to spend all this dosh on hiring Goldman Sachs or whoever to undertake an M&A deal, I suspect actually that we wouldn't be that keen. So to tackle this problem, I think you have to get right to the root of this distinction between ownership and management. It's a profound crisis of the capitalist structure that's brought us to this position.
Do you remain optimistic that capitalism can be reformed?
I'm a great fan of capitalism. I don't think the alternative is actually very attractive at all. It is, though, all about actually the type of capitalism. And I think this problem has been there with us in a sort of unrevealed form for quite a few years, actually, the last 30 or 40 or 50 years. It hasn't always been there, by the way. If you go back to the 19th century capitalism, businesses on the whole were controlled by the people who owned them. And a lot of this problem, I think, comes down to the idea of regarding the ownership of a firm as so many gambling chips to be traded in. Now, I'm rather keen on the idea of action being taken to reduce the incentive to trade, if, for instance, there were taxes on financial transactions. I also floated the idea of restricting eligibility to dividends to people who've held the shares for quite a substantial minimum period. I've actually said in my book as much as 2 years. But the idea is to actually put an incentive in the system for people to regard themselves as long-term holders. So actually, if they traded the shares in and out before then, they wouldn't actually get any dividends.
Roger Bootle, author of a new book called The Trouble with Markets, setting out for us how he thinks the flaws of capitalism can be repaired. And that's it from this review of World Business News.
The BBC World Service in the United States is distributed by Public Radio International. Distribution is made possible in part by the Medtronic Foundation, working with Teach for America to improve science and math education in communities across the United States. Information available at medtronicfoundation.org.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
WILL programs are made possible by English Hedgerow, florist, caterer, and bistro, serving locally raised and grown foods located at University and Lincoln Avenue, Urbana. English Hedgerow offers coordinated gourmet food, flowers, and decorations for private parties and other special events.
I'm Susan Hume, and on Politics UK,
This Christmas, some of the banks at the heart of the financial crisis have said they want to start handing out great big bonuses again. Politicians and public alike have howled in fury. To rein in the banks, the British government's announced a new bonus tax. But will that chase the bankers away and fatally wound the City of London as a world financial centre? All that after a summary of the world news.
BBC News with Roy Lama. Pope Benedict has delivered his traditional Christmas Day message in Rome, hours after being knocked to the ground by a woman at the start of Mass. He was not hurt in the melee on Thursday night. The Vatican says the woman, who leapt at the Pope, is now undergoing psychiatric assessment. The US has condemned a video released by the Taliban of an American soldier they captured in Afghanistan in June. He identifies himself as Private Beau Robert Bergdahl. He criticizes the US over the war in Afghanistan and American relations with Muslims. Pakistani fighter jets have targeted suspected militant hideouts in the Orakzai tribal agency southwest of Peshawar, killing at least 10 people. Pakistani officials say that those killed were militants, but local witnesses told the BBC the bombs destroyed the house of a local tribal chief, killing 3 women and 4 children. Queen Elizabeth, in her Christmas message, has expressed sadness at the number of British soldiers killed while fighting in Afghanistan. 106 have died there this year, the highest annual total since the Falklands conflict in 1982. The leader of the worldwide Anglican Church, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, has used his Christmas sermon to criticise the damaging effects of modern life on children. He said that they were being forced to grow up too quickly, crushing their experiences of childhood. In some countries, he said, racked by civil war, children were abducted or turned into killers. Thai police say that 5 crew members of a cargo plane that was found to be carrying tons of arms when it was seized at Bangkok airport 2 weeks ago have been ordered to be detained for a further 12 days. The ultimate destination of the aircraft has been the subject of rampant speculation, but the Kazakh pilot has now said that it was heading for Ukraine. And that's our latest BBC News from Bush House in London.
BBC.
Hello and welcome to a special Christmas edition of Politics UK from the BBC World Service with me, Susan Hume. Christmas time at St Michael's Church, Chester Square, in one of London's wealthiest districts. A packed congregation, many of them bankers from the financial hub, the City of London. Traditionally, Christmas is the season of giving, and for the bankers, it's the season of receiving too, because Christmas time is bonus time and bonuses are back, just months after the biggest banking crisis in living memory. The public is furious, so are the politicians. The government's try to clamp down on bonuses with a new tax. Very satisfying, but is it wise? A number of city high earners are already heading overseas, and there are threats that some banks could move part of their operations out of London. In this Christmas edition of Politics UK, we look forward to the ghost of Christmas future, to a Britain without the engine of the City of London.
My name is Mauro Sanna, and I come from Sardinia. And I own these 3 restaurants and a shop in London. Let's put it this way, I don't come from a privileged family. I'm a self-made person. I came to London about 32 years ago. I said, you know, no, I like London too much. And I thought it was a vibrant city full of opportunity. You know, I felt that I had a drive here. Allora, due carciofi con gamberi, una seppia, un tonno ai porcini, quelli che ho raccolto io, un linguine al granchio e una triglia per me. Grazie. Lunchtime, majority of people, shippers, mining, bankers, some of the most important bankers, probably in the world, they come here. Because I know them all, I talk to them all the time. I always say that I always gauge the economy by seeing what those people in the cities are doing. And I know that if those people are not making money, nobody else is making money.
city of London, it's such an important part of England. It's crazy to even contemplate on cutting their salaries or bonuses or making them run away. As a business person, I want all the people who have money to spend to come into my restaurant. So I don't want him to run away. So the government is making running people away at the moment. I think you should run a country like you run a business. Whether it's moral or immoral, some people earn a lot of money. It's the nature of the business.
And maybe he's right. The City of London is one of the world's foremost financial centres. Before the crisis, the financial sector contributed more than a quarter of all business taxes for the British government's coffers, £12.5 billion. That's around $20 billion. Employee tax was even more. The sector employed over a million people. Rich bankers might rankle with the rest of us, but they have their uses, as the BBC's chief economics correspondent Hugh Pym explains.
Well, during the boom years in the lead-up to 2007, it's thought that the City of London alone might have contributed 3 or 4% of total national annual economic output. If you include other financial services, it might have been 10% or more. It contributed to very healthy growth rates and very healthy tax revenues in the good years. It helped fund public services, schools and hospitals and so on. You've now lost a chunk of financial output related to financial services in the UK because of the crisis. And if it doesn't grow back in a hurry, you've lost a chunk of tax revenue that was there before.
Well, those are the facts, but it's not the gut reaction. Vast sums of public cash were needed to bail out the banks, and ordinary people are still struggling to make ends meet in a lingering recession. For some, the sight of bankers living it up again is too much to bear. What's more, high rewards are meant to follow high risks that pay off.
I'll tell you what the root of the problem is. It is that there is no market.
John McFaul, a Labour Party MP and chairman of Parliament's influential Treasury Committee.
If the banks fail, then they get picked up by the taxpayer. So we've got to get a market system back here. And this isn't doing the market system any good, the confidence of it, or indeed people's perceptions, public perceptions of that. So it's very important that we get that working.
It's understandable that people who are losing their jobs will be irritated at these huge salaries paid to bankers, but they are paying their taxes. They are actually feeding a lot of money back into the system.
Of course, but how are they making their money? That's the fundamental question. How are they making their money? They're making their money on cheap government money that's been put about. Our government, through the Bank of England, has put £200 billion into the economy, and the banks have to realise that. That's why they're making money, large investment banks.
When the banks got that money, it came with some plaintive pleading from the government that they should use it to boost the wider economy and start lending again to businesses and people. Vince Cable is the deputy leader of the Liberal Democrat Party, an economist himself.
It is deeply worrying that a year after the massive rescue operation which prevented the banks completely collapsing in the UK, that the banks are returning to business as usual. They apparently take no account of their wider obligations. This is particularly true in lending behaviour. Very large numbers of small and medium-sized companies that are perfectly good companies, that have got good credit history, good order books, can't get credit, or if they do get credit, it's on very onerous terms. I mean, and the government, having supported the banks, and some of them directly, should be making sure that lending flows, and it's just stepping back and letting a very, very unsatisfactory situation evolve.
But the political commentator Dominic Lawson says when it comes to pay, we'd better swallow our resentment.
Bankers are always resented, whether they're doing well or badly. In fact, they're resented if they're doing well, because people then say, oh, they're making a lot of money out of us, which is technically true, because obviously the differential between the interest rate that they pay depositors and what they pay out. And, of course, when banks go bust or nearly go bust and they're bailed out, clearly, as taxpayers, people feel very angry because they feel, well, why should we pay? These people all seem to be quite well looked after. They have these nice big skyscrapers with marble floors and executive washrooms, and they all do quite nicely for themselves. So why are we bailing them out? So, yes, of course, I understand.
But it sounds from what you say that we're quite right to feel angry with them.
Well, we're always right to feel angry if people cost us money through their own stupidity. And, of course, that has happened in a lot of cases. But I don't think we should feel angry because people do well. And I think a lot of the anger in that sense is somewhat misdirected.
But earlier this month, the stakes were raised. RBS, one of the world's biggest banks, announced it planned to pay out bonuses totaling nearly $2.5 billion. That's just a year after the government had saved RBS from closing down with a cash injection of around $60 billion. It looked like the bank was blowing a great big raspberry at the little guys who'd bailed them out. But the board of the bank threatened to resign if it was prevented from paying out the bonuses. They needed to hang on to those staff who'd made lots of money for the bank in the past year. But the finance minister, Lord Miners, wasn't having it.
I think it's worth remembering that somebody on the national minimum wage working 40 hours a week earns just over £12,000 a year. We're talking here about people who have a feeling of entitlement, of bonuses of £500,000, £1 million, in several cases more than £5, £10, £20 million. I think they've got to come back into the real world.
The result, a matter of days later, the government announced a new tax on banks. Till next April, all bonuses over $40,000 would be liable for 50% tax, with immediate effect. That's on top of a forthcoming top rate of income tax of 50%. The city is in uproar. Well over 300 banks from around the world operate in London. Ghanaian and Chinese banks complain that they didn't cause the crisis. So why the punishment? Bank chiefs are said to be on the phone regularly to the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, lobbying them to change their minds. But with a general election just months away, the political stakes are very high. Hugh Pym again.
It seems that there's almost political consensus now at a parliamentary level that something has to be done on bankers' remuneration. People just cannot accept the idea that bankers should be taking higher bonuses this year and the sort of scale that's been talked about, when most people find it very difficult to understand that the taxpayers propping these banks up and will do for several years to come.
Some argue that in addition, the bonus culture actually caused the crisis in the first place, with bankers chasing short-term gains. Alistair Heath, editor of the financial paper City AM, thinks that's a mistake.
Bonuses did not cause the crisis. Large bonuses are a consequence of profitable banks. And during the bubble, what went on really was that central banks all around the world made terrible mistakes and cut interest rates too low and held them too low for too long. That created a lot of very cheap money, which was used to bid up the prices of assets, of houses, of shares and so on. And obviously, bankers made a fortune in the process. And we got ourselves into this crazy bubble, which eventually popped with devastating consequences. So I think the root cause of this crisis was a series of errors rather than pure greed driven by bonuses.
So attacking the bonuses now is really attacking the symptoms of the problem and not the root cause of it.
That's absolutely right, yes.
The BBC chief economics correspondent, Hugh Pym again.
I've heard people, experts, academics and financiers saying they're quite concerned about this rather ugly populist mood about bashing of bankers and focusing on an issue like remuneration, which is quite small beer in their view, when the much bigger issues which need to be tackled are how do you reform the banking system? How do you ensure that there's nothing like this that's ever going to happen again? Because there's no certainty that there won't be another crisis in a few years' time. And if proper reform hasn't been delivered, who knows what might happen then and how serious that might be.
Is it a matter of the politicians really tackling the easy thing? It's easy to understand bonuses. Reforming bank regulation is a lot tougher.
I think that's absolutely right. I think there is a body of opinion that this is the easy bit, bash the bankers, get some headlines and then walk away from it. When you need to decide really what sort of banks do you want?
Mind you, the banking crisis was global, so other countries will be bringing in bonus taxes too, presumably.
There is a serious body of opinion that this does damage London. It damages the reputation of London. When he announced it, no other leading economy had done anything like this, although the French government have now come in and said they would do it. But there's a view that London is seen already the highest rate of tax is going to go up next year to 50%, and there are other
of income tax.
Of income tax, and there are other hits in terms of pension contributions by wealthy people. There is a feeling London is losing the lead it had in world financial centres and will lose out. And if you have people leaving London to move to Switzerland or the US or other places, you will lose something in terms of your credibility. You will also lose tax revenue. If these people stay, they'll pay their tax. If they're employed elsewhere, they won't pay tax to the UK, so the UK will lose out both ways.
London's rivals are cracking their knuckles with glee. Already there's evidence that some of the city's high financiers have decided to get up and go, in particular to Switzerland. The commentator Dominic Lawson again.
The Swiss, who have quite a thriving financial services industry, they are holding cocktail parties in the city and canapes all round, champagne, to get English, mostly hedge funds rather than banks, it's true to say, but to get English financial institutions and the people who work there to relocate in Switzerland. And therefore the question is, why do they think it's good for them? Why do the Swiss want to have these people in Switzerland? And the answer is, for the reasons that British governments have wanted them in England, because they pay a lot of tax, they employ a lot of people. Every bank will have millions of people who cook the meals, clean the floors, you know, supply food, restaurants supply them. They buy suits, so people who sell and make suits do very well. They're good for the holiday business, you know, and the Swiss want the same. It's a honeypot.
Mark Gunia is a Swiss journalist who was reporting on the influx of hedge funds from London to Zurich and Geneva for the Tribune de Genève, even before there was any talk of taxing bonuses.
In the last 2 years, about 20 hedge funds moved from London to Geneva. And actually, the movement is speeding up since Alistair Darling announced that the tax rate on high earnings was going to increase from next April.
Now, you've talked to a lot of people about this. Why do they say they're moving? Because it's a lot of upheaval, isn't it?
And first of all is, of course, the tax rate on high incomes that is quite low in Switzerland, around 25% in the country. And all these specialists agree that to say that this is the main reason of the movement. Then comes all sorts of other reasons, like there's a high standard of living, English is easily spoken, and Geneva is right in the middle of Europe. I remember Dominic Longcroft, who was running a business that helps these people to move to Switzerland. He was telling me that the wife of a trader could easily fly to London in the morning from Geneva, go for shopping on Oxford Street, and be back on time for dinner. So you see, it is quite a good reason to come. And Geneva is also a big financial center, so these hedge funds, they need that to sell their financial products and to find highly skilled labour.
And presumably Switzerland's very pleased to get these people.
The authorities are, of course, quite happy to have these new incomes, especially while the crisis is striking public budgets and as Switzerland as a financial centre has been suffering lately. But speaking for Geneva, the local authorities showed publicly their intention to attract these hedge funds and private equity funds.
Is it just financiers from London making the move to Geneva then, or are you finding them coming from other places, Frankfurt, for example?
No. People from Germany are not coming into Geneva. From the financial industry, it's really from the UK.
So would it be a disaster for the British economy if the bankers did jump ship? Well, their threats don't alarm the Liberal Democrat deputy leader, Vince Cable.
I'm not persuaded by the evidence on this. There are many good reasons why people want to stay in London. You know, London is a network of financial institutions. It's a good place to do business. English language is the norm. There are a lot of other like-minded institutions. There's the time zone issue. There are many good reasons, including quality of life, why people want to be here. And of course, we shouldn't go to extremes and drive people away, but I don't think there's any question that that's a realistic future.
The thread that runs through the whole dilemma, though, is one of morality. Dare the government kill the goose that lays the golden egg to appease public anger? And is that public anger justified, or is it simply envy? And maybe greed is good if it spurs bankers on to make money, which filters down throughout the economy. Well, two men who've spoken and written about this are Richard Harris, a former Bishop of Oxford and now a Professor of Theology, and Brian Griffiths, a banker himself and Vice Chairman of Goldman Sachs, who's currently giving a series of lectures at the Oxford Theological College Wycliffe Hall on markets, money and morals. I began by asking Lord Griffiths if the city was indeed driven by greed.
I wouldn't say the city myself was driven by, from my experience at least, I've been in our roughly 40 years, by greed. I think if it's driven by one thing, it is by a sense of wanting to be the best and, in a way, wanting to win, almost like in sport, wanting to do really well and, as a result, receive the prizes which come from winning.
Well, Lord Harris, why does it matter, really, if people in the city earn a great deal of money? Because prosperity is spread around the country, around the world, and society as a whole.
Well, let me make it clear, first of all, that I think that banking is a perfectly good Christian vocation. I believe in Martin Luther's idea of the lay vocation, and that if a job is serving society, a person's doing that job, they're serving God as well. I'd want to affirm that. But what I think is outrageous, obscene almost, are the differentials between bank bonuses and what ordinary people get. And it's not, let's not just focus on bankers, but it's also CEOs, chief executive officers in America in 2007. They earn 344 times the salary of the average worker. What's even more startling, in 1980, the differential was only 42 times. In other words, between 1980 and 2007, there was a jump from 42 times to 344 times. And I suspect that banking bonuses, it's even more outrageous. Are we really saying that bankers and chief executives are worth that much more in their contribution to public life than people doing an ordinary job? I think it's undermining the social fabric.
But would the poorer people be better off if the city didn't exist and those people weren't earning the money?
We do need the city to exist. And I think that genuine venture capitalism, where people take a risk in investing money, is a very legitimate thing to do, with the emphasis upon they're taking the risk themselves. They're not just taking the risk for other people's money. So it is necessary. But something has got totally out of hand. I mean, this is not something new. I felt it very, very deeply when I was Bishop of Oxford. These rural villages, you have somebody sort of desperately saving to find £2,000 or £3,000 to put down for a mortgage, to buy a little cottage or something in the country that might be £180,000, £200,000. A banker in London gets £1 million on his bonus. He goes in and just sort of buys the place up without flicking a finger. It's undermining the worth of ordinary people's labour and work and their life's endeavour. They'd save for a whole life in order to buy somewhere to live.
Well, Lord Griffiths, don't those kind of differences make you a bit uncomfortable?
Of course. And the reason is that I think I've never felt that in a market economy, and I've never argued that in a market economy, the rewards which come to people reflect in any sense a moral worth. And to the extent that all people are created in the image of God, I entirely agree with Richard that the rewards here can't be justified morally by saying they're morally in some sense superior or better. I have no problems with that at all. But I think the really interesting question that Richard raises is why is it over 40, 50 years these differentials have increased? And the only explanation I can think of for it is that much as you had in the 60s, a whole liberalization, for example, the beginning of a liberalization of lifestyle, so in the economic order, we had, especially in the city, the breakup of all cartels and a thrust of public policy, both parties, towards more competition. And I think the problem that we face, if, for example, Richard says he would like to see a more equal society, I think the question is, how do you put the genie back in the bottle? Because we now have a sort of postmodern society globally, which is very individualistic, where competition is the rule. And I think it's very hard to put the genie back in the bottle in that.
As a free marketeer, do you have any solutions? Do you know how you can do that?
Well, when you say a free marketeer, I believe in the market economy. I believe in creating wealth. I think it has Judeo-Christian foundations. But although I believe in the market economy, I'm not a libertarian. I believe in a social market economy, so that the market economy has to be fenced around by justice.
So you're looking for a way, in effect, of making bankers, making the city more moral?
Well, we'd like to see every business and every institution reach the highest possible standards that you could. What I think is crucial, not just in the city, but everywhere in business, is to create a culture within the corporation which is a responsible culture, which has high ethical standards and so on. I look back in Britain to people like Cadbury and Rowntree and Fry and so on, the origins of banks here, with a culture of very high ethics. And I think the crisis has been a wake-up call to do this. What we should be striving for is that sort of culture, which I suspect both of us would agree is the sort of culture we'd like to see in banks and in companies.
There's another aspect of this which concerns me. Advocates of the free market say, yes, well, sometimes it will fail and sometimes the price has to be paid for this. But who's paying the price now? It's the people who've lost their homes because they've lost their jobs and they can't keep up the mortgages. The bankers, on the whole, are not actually paying the price of this crisis. Many of them, of course, will have been able, without any difficulty at all, to save huge sums of money and live off the investment from that for a few years till they find another job. The price is being paid right across society. And I don't know what we do about it, but I don't think we should forget about it.
What if they all left the country? That would be very serious, would it not?
Well, I mean, there is a bit of me which says, well, you know, if they want to leave the country, that's fine by me. Do we really want them? You know, if they want to go and live in Timbuktu because they can earn an extra $10 million a year, well, I hope they enjoy it in Timbuktu. I think Great Britain's the best country in the world to live in by a long way. And if they're here, they should be grateful for being here. And I think if they're here, they should be trying to actually achieve a more just social fabric.
Well, I think, I have to say, I think the vision of them all getting to Timbuktu, apart from being a bit of an insult to Timbuktu, is something that really concerns me, because financial services in Britain are the one area where we have a comparative advantage worldwide. It pays an enormous amount in tax, I think 25% or something of all taxes. So to suddenly say, well, let them go, I think that's...
I said that was only part of me. I said part of me wanted to say that. You know, if they want to go and live in the middle of Beijing or something, well... But I quite agree, of course, the financial services are very, very important. Mm. But if a lot of those people did go abroad, the jobs would still be here. Perhaps there's another whole raft of people equally competent who'd be willing to do those jobs, and they do them just as well, without these million-pound bonuses every Christmas.
Looking ahead to Christmas futures and Christmases beyond that, do you have cause for hope that after this crisis, things will get better?
As a Christian, I'm always hopeful, but at the same time, as a Christian, I'm also a realist. I think a Christian position on life is hopeful realism. So we need to work in order to make a fairer economic system for the world as a whole. We need to go on working at it without any absolute confidence that we can achieve all that we want, but we need to go on working at it.
Lord Griffiths, how do you see the future?
Well, I like the hopeful realism because, again, as a Christian, I feel I am a person of hope. And to me, the tension in the world of finance, money and so on is that I believe we have a vocation to create wealth. But we also have a vocation, and this is what the birth of Jesus really taught us, we have a vocation to be extraordinarily, almost recklessly generous in the wealth that we create, and it should be there at the service of the world.
A lack of reckless generosity was where Ebenezer Scrooge went so horribly wrong in Charles Dickens' story A Christmas Carol. Perhaps his Ghost of Christmas Future has a warning both for the bankers and the politicians too. That's it from Politics UK. I'm Susan Hume. The programme was produced by Jane Ashley and the editor was Elaine Thomas.
Saturday evening at 6 on an episode of The Promised Land, host Majora Carter talks with multi-platinum musician, record producer, and activist Wyclef Jean. In this series about leadership and people who are making a difference in the world, Jean talks about how his charity, Yele Haiti, is making a difference in his native country, Haiti. That's The Promised Land, a conversation with Wyclef Jean, Saturday evening at 6.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting audiences with an exciting January schedule of events featuring the Van Cliburn Composition winner, Kronos Quartet, with Wu Man and Michael Rouse. More information can be found at KrannertCenter.com.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.